what does a VC do in Silicon Valley? They invest into, you know, hundreds of startups every year. Right? Same idea applied to the individual. Right? Of course, you know, we individuals usually don't have, you know, millions of dollars to scale. So what can we scale? We can scale our time.
Hey, friend, it's David Novinsky here in Brooklyn. Here at the Portfolio Career Podcast, we help you take ownership of your portfolio career and design the life that you want to live. Today's conversation is with Daniel Vassallo. I love the content that Daniel shares on Twitter. In this episode, we talk about ways that you can create friendships, build an audience, and how to think about growing on Twitter. We'll talk about how he takes a small bets approach to his career, and so you can do so too, and how Daniel has optimized his lifestyle and really focused on lifestyle first after leaving Amazon about 3 years ago. And we'll link into my website, portfoliocareerpodcast.com, a blog post that Daniel wrote where he talks about leaving Amazon despite having a lot of the traditional metrics of especially pay and why he decided to leave all that. And in addition to a handful of different small bets, small projects that he works on, he's a quarter-time executive at the startup called Gumroad. After listening to this episode, check out episode 189. Wasahil Lavinia, the founder and CEO of Gumroad, talked about quarter-time executives there as well. So that episode pairs nicely with this episode. As always, this episode with timestamp notes is available on my website at portfoliocareerpodcast.com. There you can subscribe to my newsletter called One Email Away, which has the best insights from the podcast and friend-sourced job opportunities. So excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career. Here we go, Daniel. Cool. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hi, David. Hi, thank you for having me.
So Daniel, I've got a question. As we're gonna get started here, quarter-time executive, what does that mean? And how would you like describe that to someone?
Oh, I would say the executive part is definitely I don't know what to call it, but over describing it. I'm just helping with some product management stuff on a quarter time at all, right? So it's a fractional type of work arrangement. It's asynchronous, so it's not even fixed hours at the same day or whatever. And I'm not even tracking, at least in the way I'm doing it, I'm not even tracking my hours. Right? It was an arrangement that I agreed with the founder of Gumroad. When we are talking about it, I said, I can probably allocate about 2 hours a day, roughly, just to set expectations. Is this good for you? And we decided to give it a try. So far, it's been working out, I think. It's great. You know, I encourage more people to try to find arrangements like this if they can. Gives them, you know, it breaks you out of the rigid 40-hour week work arrangement, which usually doesn't leave you more time and energy and flexibility to do other things. And it's nice to have something reasonably stable, especially when you're working for yourself, doing other more unpredictable things like launching products and other things that which are much more, you know, random with regards to how much, whether they succeed or not, or how much they succeed and so on and so forth. I hope this sort of, but there's nothing special. It's literally just a, you know, part-time, extreme part-time. Gumroad is interesting because pretty much everyone there works the same rate, between 20 and 30 hours a week, roughly. A few people like me, even less. Everyone sort of is in a freelancing like arrangement, right? They invoice the employer at the end of the month or every couple of weeks. And I know it's still new, but I really hope to start seeing it more often because I think it's a great arrangement, a new option for people who want to find something more flexible.
Yeah. And you mentioned the benefits of flexibility, which is in terms of it gives you more energy and time to work on things that are kind of maybe your own personal projects, et cetera.
I think two things. That first of all, it gives you more time, but it's also expected. That's one of the problems that I had when I wasn't in a full-time job. Even if I did have the energy to do something on the side, it was often, it could become awkward at work. Like you'd be doing something weird, right? All your colleagues are focusing all your productive energy on one thing, the main full-time job. If you were to do something different, it's just strange. Whereas this type of arrangement, it just makes it natural. Like, you know, you're expected to be doing other things, which I think psychologically as well, I think it helps. Not just the fact that it leaves you more time, but it just almost encourages you to have other things going on.
Yeah. Okay. And you left Amazon about 3 years now, I think, around, I think this month or so. Mm-hmm. And we'll link to the blog post that people haven't read that before about more of the backstory in terms of, you know, kind of leaving money on the table a path of, having a lot of success and continuing to grow. And it seemed like you really liked the work too, but really focusing in on, I think the term is kind of intrinsic motivation is something that you're really kind of passionate about.
Yeah. No, sorry. Go ahead.
and you also mentioned about Gumroad, about finding those opportunities. I think in this case, you kind of went for this opportunity, right? Like there's, it seems like, you know, maybe there's more and more arrangements like this are happening in Gumroad, and maybe other companies are starting to kind of lead it, so to speak. But in this case, I think you reached out and said, this is all that I can do, but this is what I can do. And if that works for you, like, I'm down.
Yeah, absolutely. I left the corporate world because I realized at some point that this wasn't the ideal path for me. Sort of the rigid work arrangement, working on somebody else's terms, at some point it started to wear me out, essentially, right? It's no matter how much I was getting paid or no matter how much, you know, rewards I was getting dangled, I would have been fooling myself to believe that eventually it's going to get better, because it wasn't getting better. And I was seeing people like my colleagues who are maybe a level higher or two levels higher than me, and I wasn't envying their lifestyle at all. I didn't want that for myself. The routine of going to work, you know, always stressed about work, leaving home early, all working on somebody else's terms, as I mentioned, having to ask for permission to take a few days off, all those types of things really bothered me. Right? So I jumped into something different that at the time I didn't really know what it was going to look like, mostly with the goal of trying to avoid that, essentially, that I just wanted to avoid those things that really annoyed me. I wasn't really thinking about something specific. And as I was going through different things, I did a bunch of mistakes in the beginning about what I was focusing on. I just started keeping my eyes open towards things that could allow me to increase the odds that I can make this new lifestyle sustainable, right? Not everything is ideal or everything is perfect, but I think that's something that changed in me over the last 3 years. Initially, I started probably a bit too idealistic. At first, I jumped into self-employment, believing that I'm going to be building my ideal business and building my ideal product and focusing on that. But then sort of a few months in into that journey, I started to realize, you know, this is too risky, what I'm doing. That's what if this doesn't work? When will I know if this is going to work or not? So I started to see all that uncertainty, and I didn't want to end up in a situation where I spend multiple years, you know, stubbornly focused on one thing, and then I run out of savings. I have to go back to a regular job, and I started looking at new opportunities. And I think once I changed my attitude, I started seeing things that until then I wasn't even seeing, like this arrangement with Gumroad. You know, this happened a year and a half in, right, into my journey. I wasn't looking for freelancing work or anything like that at the time. I happened to just be scrolling Twitter. I saw a post by Sahil advertising openings for programmers. I clicked out of curiosity, mostly because, you know, he mentioned that this was part-time. I wasn't thinking about me doing it, but I clicked just to take a look. And then at the end, there was a footnote that eventually I was going to look for he didn't mention part-time, but he mentioned somebody to help with product management role. And I sort of shot him an email. We talked about it and it happened, which again, I think it's fascinating, multiple aspects. This is something that probably I wouldn't have even noticed or even considered if I was just focused on one thing. That I think our subconscious starts to help us to eliminate random things when we're focused. And I think the embracing randomness, right? Embracing random things has been sort of very helpful to find things and consider things that until recently I wouldn't have even looked at, essentially. And this has been my litmus test also. I ask myself, is this something that's going to help me increase my odds of maintaining this lifestyle, like maintaining this arrangement that I have right now. It's not sort of a very, my goals aren't really, I want to launch this product or I want to make so much money from this thing. It's just, I just want to preserve what I have. That's a very downside first rather than upside first, which I think is helpful for decision making. It makes things easier to decide what to pursue and what to avoid and things like that.
And in this case, the downside is going back to full-time employment.
Yeah, yeah. I joke tweeted recently, which is actually quite a serious thing, but I sort of in a playful way, I said my only business plan is to avoid going back to a 9-to-5 job. It's sort of, I'm thinking about it that way, right? I'm thinking about, is this thing that I'm doing helping me or hurting me, or is it or is it neutral, right? I mean, if it doesn't help me, sort of I tend to ask myself, what's the point, right? Why bother? And if it's something that's going to be helping me. And then, of course, you know, once things have improved over the last 3 years, I feel like I can afford to be a bit even more selective nowadays, to be, you know, to avoid things that might help me a little bit maintain this lifestyle, but I don't need them, right? It's just because, you know, it would just be adding more things to my life and they're unnecessary, right? So I think it's also helping me arrive to a better work-life balance, right? By avoiding things that are not important anymore. You know, the first freelancing work that I was doing actually wasn't this arrangement with Gumroad. This was something else with a friend of mine who was working in, who was running a startup in the healthcare industry. And I was doing just about maybe 15 hours a month, even less that I'm doing with Gumroad, like just a little bit. I was making $2,000 a month, not a huge deal, right? But in the beginning, it was very helpful. It was something stable. It was actually the first money that I was making as a self-employed person. It gave me a tremendous peace of mind once I had something coming in compared to zero, right? But eventually, it became less important, right? And in fact, once I got the Gumroad gig, sort of I dropped that, right? It sort of became, why bother with this? Right? I had many other things that were working out, and this wasn't something that I was particularly enjoying. It was in a domain that I didn't really understand and know much about. Sometimes, you know, I was taking like, you know, these breaks of like 3 weeks between working on something, and I was even forgetting whether I leave off, right? Those kinds of things. So over time, I think incrementally, I'm being more, I'm noticing that I can afford to be a bit more selective with what I choose, basically to more selective about things that are more compatible with my preferred lifestyle, with what I like to do, and so on and so forth. All right. So
yeah, and so you mentioned about like you don't know what will kind of turn out well, whether that's an ebook, whether that's a consulting gig, a freelance gig, mm-hmm. you know, a product, yeah. etc. And so it sounds like you think like the benefits of kind of parallel paths or testing and making small bets and kind of experimenting is really beneficial and advantageous. Can you talk about, if that's the case, can you talk about, you did mention you say no to some experiments now, but the benefits of parallel paths of products or services or audience building?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think what I realized as I was navigating this new path was that it's very hard to predict what will work and what won't. Right? I mean, there seems to be a common misconception, I think, among new entrepreneurs, and I fell into this trap myself in the beginning, that you can treat entrepreneurship like a regular full-time job. You just work hard, you put in lots of effort, and surely you'll succeed if you put in lots of hard work, lots of energy. And that works in a regular job. Usually you put in the effort, you know, you exceed expectations, you get promoted, you get to keep your job, right? You get sort of, you get your payoffs there in that sort of very predictable world. When you're doing something, especially in the a new product or something along the, something of that kind, you could do all the hard work, could do everything right, have a good product, good marketing, good pricing, you have good reputation, you do everything right, and yet still fail for opaque reasons, things that you can't really understand. It's just for some reason, the timing wasn't right. For some reason, the offer didn't resonate with people. Maybe some competitor managed to resonate better. Who knows? Random, opaque reasons that could just cause your thing to fail or not to succeed as much as you were hoping. And I think the idea to try many small things is just a form of diversification, which we accept in many other form and many other domains, such as investing and other places where we recognize an element of uncertainty and an element where it's hard to predict what's going to happen. How do we invest our money typically, right? We don't often put all our life savings into one stock, for example, into Apple, right? Why? Because we know that no matter how bullish we are on Apple, for example, we know that something could happen. You know, some random law might come up in China and suddenly their revenue drops 50% and suddenly their stock tumbles 70%. Who knows? Right? So we diversify. And this is a similar approach, right? Which is not that different when you think about it. This is how venture capitalists operate. This is how book publishers operate, movie studios and Hollywood operate. They don't focus on one thing and just put everything, they go all in on one thing. A book publisher publishes maybe hundreds or thousands of books a year. Why? Because they know that it's hard to predict what will work and what won't. What does a VC do in Silicon Valley? They invest into, you know, hundreds of startups every year, right? Same idea applied to the individual, right? Of course, you know, we individuals usually don't have, you know, millions of dollars to scale. So what can we scale? We can scale our time, right? We all get 24 hours in a day. Of course, we have to sort of divide it and split it with life and family and everything. A few hours a day, how can we invest it, right? How can we do maybe 5-6 things a year? Of course, this is going to require us to be very ruthless with our selection criteria. We can't be over ambitious because there's a limit of what you can do. That's why I call it small bets. I think that require very small input. You have to be realistic, right, with what you go after, things that are small, that have a reasonably goodish odds of succeeding, right? Not shooting for the moon, but things that, even though they're unpredictable, things that might work. And ultimately, you're trading off the upside, right, for better odds. That's what's happening, right? I mean, the things that I'm doing are unlikely going to be making me millions of dollars or whatever. The upside is limited, it's capped. Most of the things are not very scalable, but at least they have a decent shot of working, right? And I can do them with small input. I can do them mostly by myself or maybe with just very little help, things that don't require me to spend months or years to try them out. And I think there's a better way of taming uncertainty. Now, I mean, what's fascinating to me is that the things that have succeeded out of the many things I tried are the ones that are probably the ones that I least expected to when I started, the ones that I wouldn't have imagined just 3 years ago because they're in domains that I probably wasn't even thinking about back then. And sometimes paradoxically, the things that had the weakest signals when I was trying them out, like the things that had the strongest signals for random reasons, turned out to be, to not pay off as well as I was hoping for. Right? Again, it's just been very eye-opening, the element of chance and randomness and things outside of my control, which made me even more convinced that this is a much more prudent strategy to find what works, to experiment, right, and to discover, you know, consider a good metaphor, I think, you know, which I think applies to business. If, you know, you're trying to find buried treasure underground and you're digging in one spot. No matter how hard you dig, if you're digging in the wrong spot, right, you're never going to find a buried treasure. And, you know, this is a completely random situation, like this metaphor. And I think that's what happens with business, that you might be hardworking on one part, but it might never lead you to the payoff because it's like the wrong direction for reasons that you can't even see. Right? So I think it's important to try many different paths, to look for feedback, right, to test frequently, take what works and throw away the rest, essentially, right? So that's sort of in a nutshell, I think, what I've been trying to do.
Yeah. And so there's randomness. And then it also seems like, you know, in many cases, some of the products are media, and that just kind of comes with time, or they're knowledge products. And that can be time, and that can be, you know, who knows, you may have, you know, like a course on a certain product or a certain platform or a certain domain that, like, you know, isn't hot right now. And then 6 months or a year later, it gets hot and you've already got the course there or the product there. And then people are like, okay, this is the only one that's there. Like, we're going to take Daniel's product.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to do things that I like to call it making time your friend, right? Things that don't have high running costs or almost zero running costs, ideally, right? That you can just leave there on the market, even though they're not succeeding potentially yet. You don't need to declare them a failure. They just haven't succeeded yet. And as you noted, sometimes, whether it's an external event, something happens that suddenly brings attention to them or brings more importance, or maybe me, I could come up with a new idea and I think, oh, maybe I could start marketing this differently, right? And I choose to give it more attention, right? It's sort of, I like having these things. In fact, I would consider it probably like now part of my selection criteria to avoid things that have high running costs, not necessarily financially, but even operationally or mentally, that I need to worry about them all the time, that things that would probably force me to have to shut them down unless they're working by a certain time frame. I try to avoid those things, that I'd like to try things that I can try them, put them out there. If they don't work, I don't even have to make a decision to shut them down or to stop doing anything with them, right? Because you can attract beneficial chance and randomness in the future, and it just gives you options to, you know, alternate attention and give them attention eventually. All right, so it's very helpful.
How many products do you think you have kind of available for sale right now?
I think probably about five, I think, in total. So basically, I have. The first project I started was a software as a service business. It's called UserBase. It's still running. It was probably my biggest failure financially because in the beginning I was doing this differently. I was investing a lot in this. I sort of fooled myself into believing that this is truly going to succeed. I was getting lots of validation signals. Nowadays I really dislike the term because it sort of almost implies something that it isn't, right? I fooled myself that there was more potential than there was really, I think. So that's still there. Again, I treat it as it's sort of breaking even. It's not making any profit, but it's sort of just breaking even. I don't know what to do with it yet. Maybe I will sell it. Maybe I'll just wait, and maybe it will grow slowly. Who knows? Then I launched a series of info products, like knowledge products. One of them was a programming book called The Good Parts of AWS, which was probably my first successful bet, I would say. Back then, I was tweeting a lot about programming topics. Sort of, I was building user base. I was writing some of the code myself. I was talking a lot about what I was doing, and sort of, I gained a little bit of a small audience, maybe 5,000-6,000 followers on Twitter who were interested about the topics that I was talking about. So I released this product, a short book, 50 pages or so, about a complex topic, and I tried to distill it down into something more easy to read, mostly for beginners. And it worked. It resonated again with people. It sold, made six figures in its lifetime. Most of them have been in the beginning. I think it's around $127,000 so far in 2 years, because I think I launched it at the end of 2019. Which was very interesting. It opened my eyes and so, wow, this is interesting. Maybe this, I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed marketing it. Back then I was wondering, probably I was thinking maybe I could create a sequel or maybe multiple sequels and continue to focus on that domain. But what happened was that once I started, you know, sharing in public some of the performance of the book, people were more interested in my marketing techniques, like in particular how I built my audience, right? And they were fascinated by somebody who had no marketing experience to come in a year or so from scratch to build sort of a small following. And I was talking a lot about that, like people asking me questions, and I was trying to answer, you know, everything that I knew on Twitter for free, where eventually I figured, you know, I have more to say about this topic. There's a limit of how much I can answer people in Twitter comments and in DMs. And I thought, why don't I do something similar? I was going to write a book initially, but then I realized maybe an even better format might be to record a presentation. It's like I'm giving a talk at a conference, but I just, you know, started Zoom by myself, shared my screen, and just talked for an hour and a half about what I learned, the mistakes I made, and so on and so forth. And to my surprise, this turned out to be even more successful financially. This is approaching $300,000 now, which blew my mind. Like, I never expected that there was so much interest in this topic. In fact, I remember texting a friend of mine just the eve before I launched it, saying, you know, I'm almost certain that it's not going to be as successful as the AWS book. I thought AWS, a topic, you know, the AWS Twitter account has like 2 million followers, something that people use professionally, you know, whereas I thought I knew that most people, there's lots of people on Twitter, but probably the vast majority were just consuming, like not producing. So I thought my market was much, much smaller. But again, like, I don't really know why. I don't really know why it resonated more, where it inspired people. There seems to be another fascinating thing that's happening, that there's even more word of mouth. The momentum carried on even longer than the other book. The other book, sort of the sales dropped to just a few hundred dollars a month. This is still making $7,000 a month a year and a half later, which, again, very fascinating. I don't know the reasons. Like, to be completely honest, I still do half a dozen sales a day. I don't know where people are coming from, right? It's just, I suspect word of mouth, or maybe they remember last year there was this guy on Twitter who launched this thing. Let me go check it out. I don't know. So there's that. Then the most recent thing that I did was I started a cohort course talking about some of these topics that we're discussing today. This is something I started just 3 or 4 months ago, where we're meeting with groups of 25 people at a time. We have like 6 sessions spread over 2 weeks. And we talk about the topics we're discussing today in just much more detail, right? Sort of starting out, taking the plunge for full-time employment to self-employment, how to think about protecting the downsides, right? Dealing with all the anxiety of uncertainty and sort of finding good opportunities, the selection criteria of what to go after, what to avoid, things like that, right? Which we also have now sort of a small community on Discord where we keep talking about these things. Financially, it's still not yet the most successful thing, but it seems like it's something that's really working well, and I'm quite bullish about it. Then, of course, I'm still doing the freelancing part. I consider that part of my portfolio as well. And I tried a few other small things that haven't really worked out well. Last year, I started selling and making handmade cutting boards, which is something completely different. It made about $5,000, not a big thing. But I'm still learned quite a lot. You know, I had never done anything in the e-commerce space. I learned about shipping and sort of dealing with physical stuff. I think it will help me. I'm still keeping my eyes open. I'm still interested in doing something else or improving this one, right? And something in the physical product space. So those are the main ones. I probably have a few other odds and ends here and there that sort of haven't really picked up yet, or will never, right? But sort of there are things that I try that don't go anywhere, right? So, so that's where I'm at right now. And to be honest, if you were to ask me, what will you be doing this time next year? I have no idea, right? I mean, I don't know yet. It's part of the fun. I'm sort of chose to embrace uncertainty, right? And to let it happen and play it by ear and sort of take the opportunities when I see them, essentially.
Yeah. How do you think kind of audience size factors into this? You know, through your course, do people have, I don't know, like 500, like, is there any anything there that you think is matters much, or anything that you've learned through the students of, like, you know, if you've got anything there, or do you have, or is it all kind of unique and different for each person?
No, what I noticed is that it's almost critical to have something that allows you to bring attention, like in business. It's critical to have something that allows you to get attention either to yourself or to your products, right? Some capability. And having an audience on social media is just one way of doing it. I know many other people who are successful, who have absolutely zero online media presence, but they still have some alternative to get attention, either to search engine optimization, either to paid marketing, paid ads, either to personal connections, just their own reputation, right, to sort of more traditional content marketing, blogging, and so on and so forth, which might overlap a little bit with social media following. I think it's important to have something, some skill to help you get attention. There are some people who are good as well. For example, in the domain of info products, they manage to rely on other platforms like YouTube or Amazon, like, to get attention, right? You don't need to do all the marketing directly yourself like I'm doing. But for example, if you have your books listed on Amazon, the platform can bring you attention, which is, of course, there's lots of randomness as well in that, but there's also an element of skill, right? To how do you get, how do you make the algorithm, you know, favor you? And it's like search engine optimization, essentially, like making sure that you're a good fit for the algorithm, right? The things are titled properly, right? The product description is a particular way. You manage to get good, you manage to convince your readers to give you good reviews, and these kinds of techniques, that there's a skill involved. So definitely, I would say having an audience is definitely not necessary. I believe I can prove it because I know many people who are successful despite not having any. Right? So it's almost invalidates the claim that it is necessary. But it certainly helps, and it certainly can be used as a way to get attention, right? I think once you do have an audience, you do have an advantage in that it's something that's a bit more predictable compared to all the other things that are more randomness laden, like Google algorithms and other things that, you know, they tend to be a bit less predictable, right? And you never know, even if you're succeeding today, you never know if something's going to change and affect you negatively or positively, right? Yeah. So it's a risk.
And for people that are trying to build an audience on Twitter, is there kind of maybe one thing or a mental model or anything that, you know, people should call it more strongly consider? Or is there anything on the Twitter side of things? And I know you've got some great tweets and threads about them and stuff as well, but just, you know, as we're talking about it live.
I think probably a mental model to make it less daunting. I think you can consider building an audience in general, probably not just for Twitter, but in general, is like how you would approach making friends in real life. That you bump into random people in random places at work or somewhere, and you talk about something that is in common, like something that interests both parties. Right? And now the way to do it effectively online, I think, is to start by going where people interested in something that you're interested in already hang out, right? Is that you might start with going to particular Reddit subreddits or particular forums, or maybe following people on Twitter and using the comments almost as a forum section, right? Because, you know, on Twitter, one fascinating thing is like communities almost start to grow under popular accounts under their own tweets, right? You start seeing people talking, and it's like you're at a party and you start seeing a bunch of conversations. You can sort of listen in, and you have the option but not the obligation to jump in whenever you want, right? So I think that's the way to do it, slowly but surely, essentially, right? It's sort of not to treat it as you know, as something complex or as a marketing activity or whatever, but it's like how you make friends in general, right? And then I think, of course, sort of Twitter and some platforms have, if you have effects where things can sort of blow up and, you know, go viral and whatever. But I don't think you need to rely on those things. You know, I went for many years, I think, before I had any particular tweet of mine you would consider have gone viral. Right? It's sort of, you just start making connections, talking to people. Like something that I highly recommend is that, especially in the beginning, is to, you know, answer every question that you get. Like this is literally an opportunity for you to build connections with people. Like whenever somebody asks something and you think you can help, just go and help, right? I think that's probably the best attitude to have, is like ask yourself, who can I help with what I know, with what I have in my head, right? And you can start going online. When you think about it, the internet is like probably there's a billion people right now on the internet trying to get help with something. Like they're going in places, going on Google, asking questions, going on Reddit or in other places and Twitter, asking questions. They want help with something. And of course, we can't help everyone, but there's probably some sliver of knowledge of domain that we might be able to help others. Right? And I think you can take a small bets approach as well with this. Of course, we don't have infinite time to help everyone 24/7. You can start trying different things and sort of then correct course along the way based on what's giving you the best ROI in terms of helping people. I remember in the beginning when I started, I was trying to do this everywhere. Like I was going on Reddit, LinkedIn, Quora, Stack Overflow, on GitHub, on Twitter, pretty much everywhere that I could think of that I could help people. I was trying to go and tinker and experiment. Eventually, I started to know there were things that I gave up on quickly. There were things that I kept doing for a few months. Eventually, I almost gravitated towards Twitter. It's the one that I felt, at least for me, in my circumstances, was working the best. It was probably the most compatible with me, with how I'd like to articulate myself and talk. But I, again, like, it was a very experimental approach, right, that led me to one that was working better than others.
I love it. I love it. I love it. A small bet approach to Twitter too. This is good. Daniel, I've got many more questions. Maybe we'll have to do a round two, but this was incredible. And it sounds like if people want to continue to learn, they can do so on Twitter. And is there anything else that you'd like to share for people to continue to learn more about kind of small bets approach and kind of creating their own lifestyle, so to speak, and as opposed to more traditional?
Yeah, I talk about these a lot on Twitter. So, people who are interested, I think, highly encourage following me. There's often many conversations under my own tweets. So again, like, feel free. There is that community that's happening under my Twitter account. That's where I think some of the ideas are very eye-opening. That I still consider my Twitter my inspiration generator. Sometimes me consuming, right? Me reading, not just me tweeting, right? Just seeing what other people are doing, which I find it very fascinating. And I really believe that's social media might, of course, be causing some harm in the world in some places, but can definitely be a very inspiring for people to see unconventional ways of how people are living their lives, and then sort of again, like, the option, but not the obligation, to get inspired and consider something like that for yourself, maybe with your own tweaks, with your own take, and things like that. So
amazing. Awesome. Thank you so much, Daniel. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
Hey, friend. Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Portfolio Career Podcast. Would love to hear what you learned and what you enjoyed. You can find me on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, whatever is best for you. And as a reminder, I'm just one email away as well. This episode with timestamp notes is available on my website at portfoliocareerpodcast.com. There you can subscribe to my newsletter called One Email Away, which includes the best insights from the podcast and friend-sourced opportunities. So excited for you to build and grow your portfolio career. Thank you so much.